Good morning, everyone. Can everyone hear me all right?
Again, Your
Yeah.
Honor. Yes, Your
All
Honor.
right. Would the marshal call the session of the Court of Appeals to order, please?
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Larkin, Judge Riley, Judge Jessen, the Honorable Michelle A. Larkin presiding.
Thank you. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It's 22nd day of July, 2020. We're doing our hearings this morning via WebEx due to precautions resulting from the current pandemic. The judges presiding this morning are myself, Judge Larkin, Judge Jessen, and Judge Riley. Judge Riley had some technical difficulty, so she's with us by phone. Judge Riley, can you hear us all right?
I can, and I really apologize. This is the first time this has ever happened.
It is bound to happen to every one of us one day as we navigate this new way of doing business, so no apologies. I don't know if the lawyers have appeared in this format before. The rules are the same. Each side will have 15 minutes for primary argument. Appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal argument. The marshal, as you can see on your screen, is holding up his cell phone, which will have a timer that displays the time, so be mindful of that. Judges typically will wave a hand if they have a question, so please be watchful. Judge Riley, I think you're going to need to be assertive, and I'll remember to ask you from time to time if you have any follow-up questions, okay?
Thank you.
We'll make sure we hear from you. Now, who's here on the first case this morning is State of Minnesota versus Carlos Sargent. Who is appearing on behalf of Mr. Sargent?
Your Honor, David Robbins of the law firm of Meyer News Tanak, Special Assistant Public Defender, appearing pro
Thank
bono.
You. Who is appearing for the State of Minnesota?
Your Honor, Ben Listrom, Cass County Attorney.
Thank you. Mr. Robbins, we're ready for your argument. You may begin.
May it please the court and opposing counsel, my name is David Robbins of the law firm of Meyer News Tanak, appearing on behalf of appellant Carlos Sargent as a pro bono Special Assistant Public Defender. On the night of November 4th, 2018, officers violated Mr. Sargent's right to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures as first, officers' knowledge of an individual's condition of pretrial release and consumption of alcohol is not in and of itself reasonable articulable suspicion sufficient to expand the scope of a Terry stop. And second, officers may not execute suspicionless searches of individuals even if an individual is on a condition of pretrial release that subjects the individual to random testing.
Counsel, can we start with your first argument? Because it would seem to me that depending on the resolution of the first argument, we may not need to reach the second. In other words, if this court were to conclude that reasonable suspicion of a violation of a condition of pretrial release is the proper subject of a Terry investigation or expansion, it would seem that we need not reach the separate question of whether random warrantless searches or breath tests or chemical tests are constitutional in and of themselves. Is that accurate?
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. Right. As for the Terry search, the facts at issue are important and the chronology of the stop is imperative for the court to understand. On the night in question, officers encountered one Elise Howard, who was a car driven by one Elise Howard, and pulled Ms. Howard over on suspicion of a moving violation, failure to signal a turn. When officers approached the vehicle, Leech Lake Tribal Police Officer Anthony Hansen approached the driver's side of the vehicle, and Leech Lake Officer Logan Welke approached the passenger side of the vehicle. Immediately upon contacting the vehicle or promptly thereafter, officers smelled alcohol emanating from the car. They began an investigation of a possible intoxicated driver by asking Miss Howard if she had been drinking that evening. When Miss Howard indicated in the negative, officers, knowing the three passengers in the vehicle from previous contacts with law enforcement, asked each of them if they'd been drinking. The record is somewhat inaudible, but at the omnibus hearing, Officer Hansen testified that Mr. Sargent indicated he had been drinking. Officer Hansen also indicated that at that time, he was aware that Mr. Sargent was on pretrial release. But importantly, he did not say that he knew Mr. Sargent was on conditional pretrial release or that he knew what those conditions were. He said he knew that Mr. Sargent had some sort of involvement in an assault investigation. He did not say that he knew that Mr. Sargent had any involvement in any alcohol-related crime. After receiving Mr. Sargent's, yes, Your Honor. Your Honor, Justin, I believe you're on mute still.
Thank you. If I can interrupt for just a moment, because this is where I just have a fundamental question I'd like you and Mr. Lindstrom both to address, and it follows up on Judge Larkin's question. So both of you premise this appeal as, well, we need to analyze this under Terry. Is this a Terry stop? And that's where I think your facts are getting to. But under Terry, the police may stop and temporarily seize a person if they have reasonable suspicion of criminal activity. And what's the criminal activity here? It's, you know, it is not a crime that's been committed or a crime that's about to be committed. So this gets to my, is Terry really the right way to approach this? I mean, and I take it that nobody's saying that at this point there was voluntary cooperation in response to non-coercive questioning, which might come up because it was just a basic question from the officer, but I didn't see that being argued. So if you could help me with that fundamental issue.
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that the state's position would be the criminal activity for which Officer Hansen was developing reasonable suspicion was a violation of a condition of pretrial release.
And is that a crime? Or is that just, well, we need to get this person back and revise these pretrial release conditions? That's the way I read it, but you all are more familiar with this case than I am.
I think that that's a fantastic point, Your Honor. Whether it is a crime or isn't a crime, I think I would argue it's not a crime. It's a violation of a court order, and potentially it could subject Mr. Sargent to confinement in jail for violating. He could be subject to a order to show cause hearing. But the reasonable suspicion, the officers don't have reasonable suspicion at that point of anything other than Mr. Sargent's had a drink of alcohol, which in and of itself is not a crime. And in order to make it suspicion of something wrongdoing, officers would need to have suspicion that he was somehow violating a condition of pretrial release. He's not a minor. Yes, Your Honor.
I appreciate Judge Jessen's question because, frankly, I view this case as raising the very issue she suggested. Does suspicion of a pretrial release condition violation warrant a Terry investigation? And I thought the same thing she did. I note that in the pro se brief, Mr. Sargent argues violating a condition of pretrial release is not a crime. I find nothing that says it is technically a crime. On the other hand, a petty misdemeanor traffic offense is, by definition, not a crime. And yet case law clearly allows a Terry stop for any traffic violation, however insignificant. So even though the language of Terry may say investigation of criminal activity, Terry has been applied in situations where the police officers are investigating activity, which by definition is not criminal. It violates the law, but it's not criminal. And the question I have is, if a judge has ordered someone not to use alcohol as a condition of release, isn't that the law? And isn't a violation of that condition a violation of law, which would justify a Terry investigation? So rather than focusing on was a reasonable articulable suspicion or not, I think we need to hammer this issue of if there was, does the law allow the police officer to investigate that pursuant to a brief investigatory seizure or expansion of a current seizure?
That's a good point, Your Honor. My argument would be, no, law enforcement wouldn't be the responsible authority for investigating that issue. Mr. Sargent was under the supervision of Cass County probation. This is so in Conoyer, this court held that probation officers were the responsible authority for supervising individuals on probation and their conditions of release. Similarly, the statute 6.02 of the Rules of Criminal Procedure does not grant law enforcement authority to supervise.
But counsel, the criminal rules do grant law enforcement the authority to arrest for a suspicion of a pretrial release violation based on probable cause. So, you know, an officer can arrest somebody for violating pretrial release. Given that's the law in Minnesota, and that doesn't have to be the law, but that is the law in Minnesota, why can't an officer stop someone to investigate a suspected pretrial release violation? I'm having a hard time figuring out how to reconcile those two principles. And I'll tell you this, I've looked, my clerk has looked long and far for a case that addresses this. We found only one case, I think it was New Mexico Federal District Court, said suspicion of a pretrial release violation is not a basis for a Terry stop. However, in that case, the law of the state did not permit police officers to arrest for a conditional release violation. The law said if there was suspicion of a conditional release violation, you had to go get a warrant. Our state allows an arrest on that basis. So if we allow an arrest for a conditional release violation, how could we reasonably say you can't investigate it?
That's a fair point, Your Honor. And perhaps that would distinguish this case from the case that you're citing in New Mexico.
I think it does.
Yep. But I still do think, let's assume, for instance, that officers can investigate under Terry.
Okay.
I still think that the threshold question of whether or not officers have reasonable, articulable suspicion is going to be a tough burden for the state to overcome here, simply because they have to know specifically, not even specifically, but they have to know generally why Mr. Sargent is on pretrial release. And I'll go into the parade of horribles here. Go ahead, Your Honor.
The case law regarding Terry investigation tells us that police officers are allowed to rely on their training and experience in determining whether there's reasonable articulable suspicion. I think it would be fair to say that even though a police officer may not know the specific conditions of a person's pretrial release, a police officer generally knows what happens in court and what those conditions generally look like. And as a former district court judge, I can tell you there are very few cases in which some sort of limitation on chemical use is not part of pretrial release. It's a condition in most cases, not all, but most. So why wouldn't we give the officer the benefit of that knowledge? If he knows Mr. Sargent, he knows he has a criminal history, he knows he's a suspect in an assault, he knows he's on conditional release. Is it so far-fetched for the officer to reasonably think he maybe shouldn't be drinking? I mean, after all, Terry is simply, you can't act based on mere whim, caprice, idle curiosity. It doesn't seem to me that that's what the officer was doing here. I mean, it's not a situation where he doesn't know the individual. He knows quite a bit about Mr. Sargent, given the totality of the circumstances, even though he may not have the precise conditions of release in front of him.
Well, Your Honor, he doesn't know he's on conditional release, for instance. He knows he's on pretrial release, but he doesn't ever state that he's on conditional release. And I would argue that given this court's framework set up for when, and the rules for when an individual can be imposed a condition, right? The rules presume non-conditional release. A judge has to go through an analysis of 13 factors, and this court specifically abhors blanket conditions of release. So knowledge in an individual is somewhat involved in an assault wouldn't in and of itself lead one to believe, an officer to believe, that there would be a condition of release that would prohibit an individual from drinking intoxicating beverages. I would say that this case is somewhat analogous to State v. Gilchrist, a 1990 Supreme Court case, which says that knowledge of an individual's past criminal behavior cannot be grounds for reasonable suspicion unless that criminal behavior is related to the crime being investigated. Here, the crime being investigated, well, possibly he's on violation he's violating a term of pretrial release, right? A condition of pretrial release. So the officer has to assume A, he has a condition, and B, one of such conditions includes he cannot drink alcohol. But at the time, I think the transcript and the video transcript and Officer Hansen's testimony makes it clear, he didn't know. He had to specifically confirm, number one, with Mr. Sargent, are you on a no drink? And number two, he has to call Cass County Probation out. Yes, Your Honor.
So I think, as I understand your argument, that's the first unlawful expansion, asking Mr. Sargent if he's on a no drink condition. And is it your position that despite knowing that Mr. Sargent has a criminal history, he's on pretrial release, he's a suspect in an assault, it was unreasonable for the officer to suspect that he had a no use condition? Because that's what it would come down to. We would have to say it was objectively unreasonable to think the court had ordered him not to use chemicals while on pretrial release.
Yes, Your Honor. I would change it to say it's unreasonable for him to assume that he had that condition. Knowledge of pretrial release in and of itself can't be knowledge of a no drink.
But he's not, the standard is not whether he assumes it. The Fourth Amendment is all about reasonableness. Was it reasonable for the officer to suspect that he had a no use condition?
Obviously, I would answer that in the negative. I don't think it was reasonable.
Okay.
And furthermore, I think the scope or the duration of the stop is expanded immediately when Officer Hansen walks away from Miss Howard at the vehicle and leaves her behind, because the original purpose of the stop is done. I see I'm out of time, so for that reason, I will ask the court to remand back to the lower court with instructions to exclude the evidence.
Okay. And counsel, I just want to, because we have kind of taken up quite a bit of your time. First, Judge Riley, do you have any questions on this topic?
I don't. You and Judge Justin have asked my questions. Thank you.
All right. Counsel, in fairness, I'm going to give you a few more minutes if you'd like at this point to address the second part of your argument regarding the constitutionality of warrantless searches as conditions of release, and I'll give the state a few more minutes as well.
Thank
Mr.
you, Your Honor. Robbins,
if you'd like to, why don't we say 5 minutes?
Thank you, Your Honor. I would like to address that issue briefly. As Your Honor correctly pointed out, this court need not reach this issue if they determined that there was reasonably articulable suspicion of criminal activity. If there wasn't, though, I think the state's argument here is that because Mr. Sargent was on a condition of random testing, law enforcement could execute a suspicionless search of Mr. Sargent without violating his constitutional rights, and it doesn't implicate the Fourth Amendment. However, I would refer this court to Knoyer, which I earlier referenced, along with recent decisions in State v. Reyes, and then just this month, State v. Londo, which cites with approval Knoyer. And Knoyer stands for the idea that law enforcement may not execute a suspicionless search of an individual on probation. Yes, Your Honor.
But isn't this different, where here we do have law enforcement checking in with probation? And, you know, they ultimately say, as I recall the record, oh, bring him in, which my recollection did not happen in Knoyer.
Yes, Your Honor, and that's true. However, the timing matters. So they don't check in with law enforcement until after they've already seized and searched Mr. Sargent. They don't know that he's even subject to a conditional pretrial release at that time until they get confirmation of it from Cass County Probation. So they put the cart before the horse a little bit. They execute a seizure and a search of Mr. Sargent, and then they seek supervision from Cass County Probation. The proper procedure would have been for officers to get back in their squad car, let Mr. Sargent go, call Cass County Probation and say, we made contact with Mr. Sargent. We believe that he may be in violation of one of his conditions of pretrial release, and you should follow up with him. That would have been totally proper and above board because Cass County Probation Department was in charge of supervising his conditions of pretrial release, not Leech Lake Tribal Police. So when officers approach the vehicle and begin asking Mr. Sargent questions targeted at soliciting evidence of criminal activity or wrongdoing, this case looks a lot like Fort. There is no ongoing investigation of for which officers have reasonable articulable suspicion. It's suspicionless, and they begin probing Mr. Sargent for evidence of potential criminal activity or wrongdoing in violation of his conditions of pretrial release. He is at that point, if he hasn't been seized before, he is at that point seized, and that seizure is without suspicion. And for that reason, and because he should be granted at least the same constitutional rights as individuals on probation, given that he hasn't been convicted of a crime, he hasn't had his right to a jury trial, he's presumed innocent, he should be afforded at least the same rights as probationers, as this court seems ready to afford probationers in these types of cases. And for that reason, on the second issue, I don't think the state can avail itself of the conditional random testing in order to make the search of Mr. Sargent constitutionally above board. If there are no questions, yep.
Counsel, you're referring to the search. By search, do you mean the PBT?
No, I would even say the seizures before that, right? The questioning of Mr. Sargent, are you on a no drink? I think that right then is when Mr. Sargent seized, because this is...
Well, what search, when you say it was an unconstitutional search, which search are you referring to?
Then the PBT. The PBT is a search. And
what do we do about case law that says PBT is not a search? And you only need reasonable suspicion to do a PBT. You don't need probable cause or a warrant to do a PBT.
Well, they got the reasonable suspicion from the unlawful seizure of Mr. Sargent.
All right. So you're using the word search, but not in the technical sense, which it's used in case law concerning PBTs.
Okay. Correct. Yeah. So the violation here is the are you on a no drink, that probing that question. And I think State v. Fort would govern there.
So do you agree if a court were to conclude the question, are you on a no drink, is not or was not an unlawful question, at that point, the ball's rolling. I mean, we now, are you on a no drink? Yes, I am. He now says he's been drinking. He says he's on a no drink. They confirm he's on a no drink. They give him the PBT. He's been drinking, and now we've got probable cause, arrest, search incident to arrest. It seems like the ball's rolling. And for your argument to prevail, we really need to conclude that the question, are you on a no drink, was unconstitutional.
I would say you have to conclude that Mr. Sargent was not seized.
I think he's seized. He's in a car and it's clear he's not free to go. So he's seized. I think your expansion argument is you had no business questioning him about anything.
Right. Precisely.
Okay. Understood. Thank you. We will give you your 5 minutes of rebuttal time. And now we will hear from Mr. Lindstrom on behalf of the state. Mr. Lindstrom, you're muted, I think.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can hear you now. Thank you.
Okay. Some of my videos, Your Honor, are cutting in and out, so if I don't see a hand wave, that's probably why. May it please the court, Ben Lindstrom on behalf of the state and the Cass County Attorney. I want to start by addressing the expansion issue that was raised first off. And this notion of, is there an underlying crime being investigated? I think the court made a point about conditions of release essentially being a lawful order or a law in that case. I think there's another statute that actually relates to contempt, a Minnesota statute 588, And there's actually a crime of contempt, a misdemeanor crime, to disobey a lawful order or process of the court. So in terms of
counsel, there being... Can I ask you about that? Because it was my recollection that this court, I think Judge Riley authored the opinion, has written on whether or not contempt is properly used as a criminal sanction for violations of pretrial release or conditions of probation. And I thought this court had held that it is not properly used in those circumstances.
This is Judge Riley. I did write that opinion. It was affirmed by the Supreme Court. But the issue there was that certain police departments where if they found a probationer and cited him or her for, say, trespass or something, and they had violated the terms of their probation conditions by drinking, they were found drunk, in other words, the police would cite them for misdemeanor contempt without ever going back to court. So it's a little bit different than what we have here.
So yeah. The case does not hold that contempt cannot be a remedy for a violation of court order. The case addressed more the process by which that sanction would be imposed?
Correct.
Thank you.
And, Your Honor, my recollection of the case, I haven't read it in a while, was essentially that the district court had dismissed the citations, and the appeal was on whether or not the district court had the authority to do that. And given the nature of the contempt power, I believe the dismissals were upheld. But in any event, there still is that statutory framework that would underpin this notion that conditions of release and the court's orders are crimes in the sense that Terry would apply. So in terms of this particular case, I think you have to go through that analysis that kind of starts in the Askaroot decision. We have a stop that's based on a traffic violation, and while investigating that traffic violation, you have a law enforcement officer that approaches a driver, smells alcohol. Well, he's in a lawful place addressing the initial stop, but that smell of alcohol allows him to expand and determine, hey, where's this coming from? He asks the driver if they're drinking. They say no. He asks the other passengers, are they drinking, including Mr. Sargent? He says yes. The officer at that point is aware that Mr. Sargent had been bailed or released from jail recently. He was familiar with his history. Does he know all of the specific conditions? Did he have a certified copy of the court order that outlined verbatim what the judge had ordered? No. But I don't think that the Fourth Amendment or reasonable suspicion would require that level of knowledge on behalf of the officer. I do think the notion that he has history with the officer, that he was recently released from jail, and that he admitted drinking are enough to then ask that next question. Hey, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Mr. Lindstrom, I know you're talking about reasonable suspicion now, but I just want to know, when is the earliest that you believe this officer had probable cause? Since we know under Rule 6.03, if there's probable cause to believe someone is violating their release conditions, the officer had the ability to arrest them. That's clear.
So. Sure. So when would he have probable cause of the specific release condition? I would say when he confirmed with probation. So he had reasonable suspicion to detain Mr. Sargent, to flesh out was he drinking, and that there was a potential condition of release that required him to refrain from use. And then that's why he called the probation agent to confirm the specific condition. And then that's the moment I would say he had probable cause to arrest.
Was the PBT before or after confirming the no use? Was that after the confirmation of the no use?
I believe it was before, Your Honor.
Okay. Does the PBT factor into establishing probable cause to believe he was drinking?
It certainly is evidence of drinking, but I don't know that it's dispositive because you do have an admission from Mr. Sargent that he was drinking.
My recollection, I think we kind of accept in DWI case law that if you've got a PBT, that's probable cause that you're drinking and driving. I don't understand why that principle wouldn't apply here. I mean, the PBT establishes you've been drinking, probable cause.
Correct. And I would say it maybe establishes more than probable cause, but certainly the admission in my mind establishes it. I don't think there's an issue with requesting the preliminary breath test based on the admission to drinking, just to confirm it, you know, so before you start waking up all the probation agents and whatnot to confirm the other aspects of the investigation.
All right. So what you're saying is probable cause existed with the admission of drinking. You didn't even need the PBT, but certainly the PBT confirmed the admission.
Correct. And so, you know, as you're going through the expansion analysis, you know, ultimately the driver is determined to not have been drinking, but at that point you already have an admission from Mr. Sargent that he had been drinking, and that's what allows the detention to continue and the investigation to expand and continue. And so I would be asking the court to consider that incremental expansion. And to note that the expansion is related to what the officer is observing. There were a couple cases cited in the brief, I think it was Burbach and Fort, that related to officers asking additional questions. Hey, are there drugs or weapons in the car, et cetera? Those are the types of questions that weren't related to initial observations by the law enforcement officer. You know, so driving after revocation wasn't related to are there drugs and guns in the car. Whereas here, you have the smell of alcohol, you have Sergeant being known to law enforcement, you have him known to be having been recently released. So the coming back and saying, hey, are you on conditions of release? That is a legitimate question based on what the officer knows at that point. So I would be asking the court to go through this analysis, find that there was a basis to expand the seizure, including expansion into searches with the preliminary breath test and taking the time to call probation and find that the stop was valid. This second issue involves random testing, and is that an appropriate condition on a pretrial? Certainly the court has addressed random testing in the context of probation. The court has not taken necessarily issue and said probation agents can't do random testing, but the question here is whether it's permissible on pretrial. And I think it's important to note that, yes, on pretrial, a person is presumed innocent. They still have constitutional rights. The Constitution still applies. But in every case where we charge somebody with a crime, there is a diminished constitutional right. I mean, probable cause allows us to bring somebody to jail to keep them there away from their homes. And, you know, that's still when they're presumed innocent. And that is clearly more intrusive than saying you're subject to random testing. So I think ultimately the court mentioned earlier, the standard under the Fourth Amendment is reasonableness under the totality of the circumstances. And so when you look at random testing as a condition that can ensure public safety and whether somebody will come to court, that is a reasonable condition under our Constitution, as well as Rule 602, which addresses conditions of release. There was some conversation about probationers and pretrial people having constitutional rights, and somehow somebody on pretrial has fewer constitutional rights. I would distinguish the notion that they have fewer rights on pretrial and say that they have different rights, because the purposes of probation, which I think are related to the statutory scheme under 609.135, are very different than the purposes of conditional release under Rule 6 of our criminal procedure. Rule 6 is about will you come to court and public safety. Those are the two things that the court needs to take into account when setting conditions and bail. And, you know, there are conditions of probation that would be appropriate for probation that in turn would not be appropriate conditions on conditions of release. So, for example, more of those rehabilitative conditions that you'd find on probation would likely not be constitutional as a condition of pretrial release. So a year of inpatient treatment might be appropriate for probation, but it's not one of those conditions that would necessarily be related to assuring appearances so the process pretrial can play out. So ultimately, I think the underlying purposes of Rule 602 need to be taken into account when the court decides the reasonableness of what the Fourth Amendment is requiring in that context. And so ultimately, I would be asking the court to consider the reasonable provision as appropriate. And then I would also be asking the court to find that the stop was appropriate in this case. And I think the court already hit on it that the Rule 6 does contemplate law enforcement arresting people when there's probable cause to believe there's a violation. Are people still able to hear me?
Yes.
Okay, I apologize. All my videos went out except for the clock. So I'm asking the court to affirm the district court in this case.
Thank you, counsel. Do either of the panel members have any questions for counsel?
I don't.
Thank you.
Neither do I.
All right. Mr. Robbins, we're ready for your rebuttal argument. And could I ask a question for you to address during your argument? And that is, do you have any quarrel with the officer initially asking the other passengers whether they had been drinking? So before he gets to the point of asking Mr. Sargent if he was on a no drink, he asked him if he had been drinking. Do you have any constitutional quarrel with that question?
Your Honor, that is a question I have myself grappled with. I think asking someone whether or not they've been drinking alcohol, you know, Officer Hansen at that point is trying to determine where the smell of alcohol is emanating from the vehicle. And asking whether someone's been drinking alcohol is not soliciting evidence of a crime, right? Have you been drinking alcohol itself as a passenger in the vehicle is innocuous. But if Officer Hansen knew that an individual specifically, again, if he knew that someone was prohibited from drinking, right? If he knew that someone was a minor, say this is State v. Shenzing, he knew someone in the vehicle was a minor, he has reasonable suspicion at that point in time that there's a crime of underage drinking. If he knew that someone in the vehicle was on conditional pretrial release that said no drink, he would be soliciting evidence of crime, and I think he'd have reasonable suspicion to do that. But in and of itself, I don't take issue with asking whether or not someone's drinking alcohol. That in and of itself is not soliciting evidence of a crime. As to whether or not probationers or individuals on pretrial release would be subject to, you know, distinctive constitutional protections here, I want to briefly address the state's position. It is true that they are in a different procedural posture in this case. It is definitely true that an individual on pretrial release is presumed innocent. The framework within 6.02 doesn't provide for authority for greater conditions of release, though, in my opinion, it provides for lesser conditions of release, and those conditions need to be tied reasonably to whether or not individuals, they're necessary to secure an individual's appearance at future court dates and protect public safety. So contrast that with the statute governing probationers. Probationers generally are going to get conditions. They're presumed to get conditions. Individuals on pretrial release will not unless a court engages in an analysis of 13 factors and they narrowly tailor those conditions to secure the appearance and for public safety. From my perspective, knowing of an assault, right? So Officer Hansen says he knows about Mr. Sargent, but he never says on the record, he never articulates on the record how he knows of Mr. Sargent, what his criminal background is, whether he's been engaged in DWIs, whether he's been engaged in drug offenses. All he says is, I have knowledge of him being involved in an assault. That knowledge, coupled with being on pretrial release, my argument is, cannot reasonably be drawn out to say he's on a no drink. I would look at this as, again, a slippery slope, where if an officer is in court one day and sees an individual in the courthouse, in the criminal court, do they then have reasonable suspicion that that individual is on a conditional pretrial release? I would posit no. That's not distinct from Mr. Sargent. All Officer Hansen knows is he's on pretrial release. That's it. An officer can also presume that a lot of people in courthouse during a criminal hearing are on pretrial release. So if Officer Hansen says, I specifically know Sargent's on pretrial release, can he also then assume that someone he saw in the courthouse earlier in the week be on pretrial release? And wouldn't he also be able to assume that that individual might have conditions, including maybe having a no drink? To me, it's too many logical leaps for Officer Hansen to engage in, and the state clearly has a less restrictive investigatory power that they can avail themselves of, because Officer Hansen could simply go back to the squad vehicle and call Cass County probation and say, oh, by the way, we made contact with Mr. Sergeant, and I believe he may have been drinking. Yes, Your Honor.
According to my understanding of the record, the officer was able to confirm Mr. Sargent's conditions of release through dispatch. So if the officer was able to do that without even asking, are you on a no drink, how bothered should we be by that question? It seems like inevitable discovery. I mean, we agree the officers have the ability from their squad to find out exactly what the conditions are. So how unreasonable is it to ask the question when you're faced with someone who smells like alcohol and admits they've been drinking?
So that's similar to the case of, get you the citation. Let's see. State v. Johnson, 645 Northwest 2nd, 505. It's Court of Appeal opinion from 2002. It's unreasonable for court or for officers to get an individual's ID and bring it back to do a warrant check when they're a passenger in a vehicle without reasonable suspicion that they're engaged in a crime. Here, Officer Hansen, in his own time, without expanding the duration of the Terry stop, could potentially call in and say, hey, is he on a conditional pretrial release? But he doesn't do that here. He instead waits to investigate the initial, is Ms. Howard intoxicated driver? And then after that, he expands the scope of the stop to investigate Mr. Sargent.
All right, thank you. Thank you both for your arguments. The matter is very well briefed and argued and is now submitted. You'll have our decision within 90 days as required by statute. This concludes the hearing. Thank you.
Thank you for your time.